It's Philosophy Talk.
The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information.
What good old-fashioned artificial intelligence got wrong, connectionism gets right.
Connectionism.
A theory that promises to solve mysteries about how humans learn and reason.
They didn't have connectionist computers in the film 2001. They got into trouble.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Connectionism versus the language of thought.
Computers that can learn from experience in the way that humans do.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Our guest is Jay McClellan from Stanford University.
Connectionism, coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, we're going to discuss an innovative theory of how the mind works based on how the brain and its neurons actually work. That theory is called connectionism.
Classical computers, like the one you probably have on your desk, do many things quite well that we humans don't do so well. And they do badly many things that we do pretty well, like learning. So they're really not very good models of the human mind, but neural computers do well what we do well and tend to do less well what we do less well. They're a much more promising model for
me. One of the things you mentioned, learning from experience, is one of the things that humans do well, and neural computers do that well. So we'll start by looking at the problem of learning and what kind of problem it presents and show how that helps motivate connectionism.
Next, we'll examine a few of the main ideas behind connectionism. Ideas that explain in a biological and neurological way how the mind does what it does.
You know, connectionism has had some remarkable successes, but there are still skeptics out there who think it's entirely on the wrong track. We'll close by examining the basis for that skepticism.
So, Ken, if you opened up my brain and put it under some kind of scope, what do you think you'd see?
Well, you'd see, first of all, a bunch of neurons, and they contain a lot of electrical chemicals. There are these synaptic connections between neurons. Electrical impulses travel along those synaptic connections, and when one neuron receives an electrical impulse from another, it does different things. One thing it can do is get really excited and start sending out more electrical impulses of its own, or sometimes it get really kind of tamped down and start sending out fewer and fewer and fewer. And that's basically what goes on in the brain.
Well, Ken, I'm very impressed with your knowledge, and I thought your imitation of a neuron was particularly good. But let me tell you, if you open up my mind, you're going to find a lot more than that. I don't know about yours, but my mind is full of thoughts and ideas and all kinds of interesting things like that. Where are you going to find those things in all this gooey stuff? Where are the thoughts? Where are the ideas?
Well, you know, your problem, John, is that you're starting from the top of the mind and trying to work down to the bottom of the brain, and you're kind of puzzled at how you can get there. But connectionism tells you to start over. Start in a different place. Start from the bottom of the brain rather than the top of the mind and work your way up to the mind.
You've kind of lost me, Ken.
Well, you think of these little dumb little neurons. Well, think of each one as kind of a very limited computing device, and then think of networks of neurons as a less limited computing device, and then networks of those, you know, each with their kind of specific job to do. Individually, they don't do much, but when you put them all together, you get a device with an amazing computational power, and that device is the mind.
Well, let me try a metaphor to see if I'm catching on at all. Suppose you're in your office at Stanford. You don't want to be bothered by textbook salesmen, but you don't mind being bothered by students because, after all, they pay all the bills. So you put some detectors outside your door to tell the difference. But instead of putting one big student or salesman detector, like having an assistant just look, you decide to string together a bunch of many more limited detectors.
Yeah, right. Maybe one of the detectors is just looking for skateboards, and one's just looking for neckties, and one's just looking for whether the shirt's tucked in or shirt's tucked out. And if it sees, you know, say the skateboard detector, it says, skateboard, skateboard, skateboard. It gets really excited when it sees a skateboard or something. And none of these detectors individually detects a student or a salesman, right?
Well, I guess the next thing you'd want to do then is add some higher-level detectors. Their job is to detect the output of the detectors. Maybe one of the new detectors tries to calculate the age of the person at the door, or to determine just how flaky this person at the door is. Maybe a third tries to determine the maturity level. All I have to go on is output from the first level detectors.
Right, and then you get a third level of detectors that takes the output from the second level detectors and kind of sums them up and adds them up and says, oh, there's a middle-aged, tucked-in, tie-wearing, and it says, salesman, right? Or the other ones as students. And that's how it works. You don't, none of these high-level detectors don't see the outside world. It just sees these other neurons, as it were.
Well, we've just described in metaphorical terms a connectionist neural network. Each little neuron has a very limited job. Their computational power is in the numbers and the organization. If the brain is a computer, probably it's that kind of computer.
Now, traditionally, one thing that separated the mind-brain from sort of ordinary classical computers was their ability to deal with and understand spoken language. One place where connectionism has had an impact is in speech recognition devices. A roving philosophical reporter, April Demboski, went out and talked to some computers. She files this report.
We've all had our fair share of talking to computers.
Thanks for calling American Airlines.
At airlines, banks, directory assistants.
Main menu. Please say reservations, flight and gate information, or you can say more options.
Some computers are more understanding than others.
Let me ask you a few questions so I can transfer your call correctly.
But how exactly do they know what we're saying?
The technology takes a huge amount of examples of speech. I mean, literally tens of thousands of hours of speech. And massages it for huge amounts of time to come up with a model of the way we talk.
Bill Mizell is a former professor of electrical engineering at USC.
They have dictionaries where words are spelled phonetically, and they have models of the way we pronounce those phonemes, and then puts together those models of phonemes and says, okay, here's how that word must be pronounced. And then it matches it against what you were saying when you, say, call into a call center.
At first, these programs were designed to save call-in center employees from answering the same questions all day long. Today, companies are developing products aimed at making the customer's life easier.
In a time when staying connected means everything.
A new system from Ford and Microsoft lets drivers control the entertainment features of their cars without pushing any buttons.
Introducing Sync.
Call Tom Sell. Play track, middle of the night.
These systems are not recognizing words. Even letters are too complicated. Instead, the systems are taught to recognize fractions of letters. Dan Klein is assistant professor of computer science at UC Berkeley.
Just like different musical instruments have different frequencies because they're shaped differently, as you change the shape of your mouth, different frequencies appear in the sounds that come out. And that's actually what we use to identify what people are saying. So you can say call and then someone in your address book. Or you can say play and then some song that's in your iPod.
This is especially important for more complex recognition programs, like dictation software.
My name is Kitty Cohn. I'm retired and I'm working on a novel now.
Cohn has been using speech recognition software since the early 1990s.
I have muscular dystrophy. And it's a progressive disability, so I lost the muscles in my arms and hands that would enable me to use a keyboard. Wake up. Click dragon pad. Dear Jorge, comma.
Today, Cohn uses a program called Dragon Naturally Speaking. With it, she sends emails, works on her novel, and writes letters to her son.
Have you gotten the molding and the new paint yet?
Cohn's voice is picked up by a microphone on the top of her computer monitor. If she makes a mistake,
scratch that.
She edits with her voice.
Back two words, comma.
With Dragon, Cohn types up to 80 words a minute.
New paragraph, much love, comma, mom.
Though the technology of speech recognition has improved dramatically in the last several decades, engineer Bill Mizell says that's not what's important.
The idea is the functionality, not the technology. The model I like to think of that we're moving toward is that of a personal assistant. So you don't go navigating trying to guess what category your application that you want on the phone is. You just say what you want and get it.
Sync. The next bold move meets the road.
Technology. It's keeping us better connected, one new gadget at a time. For Philosophy Talk, I'm April Demboski.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest today is Jay McClellan. He's professor of psychology at Stanford University, one of the founding fathers of the modern connectionist movement, and co-author of Semantic Cognition, a Parallel Distributed Processing Approach. Jay, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks.
Jay, tell us briefly how you got into psychology and how from there you got to connectionism.
I got into psychology because I was fascinated with my own behavior and the behavior of other people around me. I went to college during the uprisings in the late 60s, and I saw people doing strange things I couldn't explain from what they said to me, and acting in ways that seemed irrational. And I needed to understand better, you know, what made people behave.
And then you went to psychology graduate school, and they made you study rats, I bet.
Well, you know, I actually studied pigeons as an undergrad.
You're old enough to be a pigeon man.
Right. Yeah. But my advisor in graduate school talked me out of that. And we started to think about, you know, how people learn concepts and things like that. But I think another really huge influence on my development as a scientist was a class I had where I learned something about how the brain processes signals coming into the eye. And they taught me in that class, you know, how to think about how a percept, an experience, could arise from signals being passed around by neurons.
So learning is one of the age-old problems of psychology. Is that connectionism's biggest success story?
I would say it's the thing that has motivated people the most to continue exploring connectionist
frameworks.
Okay, so
why would learning motivate us to be connectionist rather than good old-fashioned AI, classical cognitive stuff?
Well,
why?
You know, the good old-fashioned AI approach is sort of usually taken as its starting place, the notion that our thoughts are already pre-structured in particular kinds of ways. And when you think about the notion of human language, for example, Chomsky told us that, you know, we had to imagine that the structure of all human languages was pre-specified in our genes. And, you know, it just doesn't make contact with the fact that not only the way we talk, but the way we think is just dramatically influenced by all the experience that we have.
Well, so wait a minute. So let's say the reason Chomsky thought that all this stuff about language is already pre-structured in our genes is because we acquire it so easily with so few errors and all that stuff. I mean, he's got this complicated argument for basically we come into the world knowing not maybe a specific language, but the general structure of any humanly possible language. And we just basically have to learn a little bit like our vocabulary and the exact syntax of our language. But you think there's something wrong with those arguments. But why? I don't want to anti-Chomsky, but sort of pro-connectionism. What is it that makes you think, you know,
well,
it's not pre-structured?
Yeah.
And how does connectionism kind of help us deal with that?
Well, you know, in the early days of thinking about neural networks, people were very excited about how the brain might learn. But they had ideas about exactly what the rules were that caused one neuron to change its connections with another one. And those ideas weren't particularly strong. They didn't get us very far, and they were easy to criticize. When connectionism came along and suddenly took hold in the early 80s, it was largely because a group of really smart people began to sort of think about ways of making better algorithms, better computer simulation models of how neurons learn to change their connections. And that suddenly opened up the possibility that lots and lots of stuff that we thought was pre-programmed could actually be acquired.
So you said something really that I want to emphasize before we go to the break. You said neurons basically learn by changing their connections. So neurons are in this interconnected web, and when you kind of change the way they connect it, they're connected. That's how a neuron learns.
That's
how
exactly
a brain system learns,
right?
We're going to have to expand on that a bit more. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're discussing connectionism, an innovative theory of how the mind works. Our guest is Jay McClellan from Stanford University.
Listeners can make this a two-way conversation. Do you feel like your brain is a big connectionist network? Or do you feel more like a classical computer? Or maybe you're just a bright Silicon Valley type who knows a lot about this stuff and can help us discuss it. In any case, join us by calling toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917.
Neural computing plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
We're making the connection with connectionism, an innovative theory of how a complex system like a human brain, like a human being, I should say, can learn from experience. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. I'm sure we have many computer-savvy listeners or even neuroscientists or students of cognitive science out there who can add to this conversation. Join us. The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917, or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Jay McClellan from Stanford University.
So, Jay, we were just talking about how a neural network learns and how it's a model, plausibly, of how a brain learns, since a brain is a big, complicated neural network. Tell me more about learning and connectionism and why it's a big sort of positive point for your kind of approach.
Well, the brain, we know the brain is shaped by experience. And neuroscientists can ask the question, how do the signals that neurons receive change the way they respond to those signals in the future? So we can ask the question, you know, under what circumstances does a neuron become more or less responsive to the inputs that it gets from a certain other set of neurons? And it's by looking at that that we can ground our thinking about how the brain, how the mind learns, essentially, in something fundamentally physical.
So Jay, it would help me and maybe a few other members of the really older generation, the pre-pigeon generation, if you could discuss the relation between connectionism and something I learned very early, associationism. Associationism seemed like a very common sense idea that the mind makes associations, and you know, when something good happens, the association gets stronger, and when something bad happens, it gets weaker. Is this a modern version of the same idea?
It is a modern version of the same idea, but it has one really powerful advantage. So my short take on associationism goes like this, that associations get formed when things occur together.
Mm-hmm.
We learn by contiguity. And then because new things happen, that doesn't tell us what to do. So we have to generalize. And we generalize by similarity.
Mm-hmm.
Something similar to what happened before happens, and it leads us to have the similar association to what we had before.
Yeah, up to now we can call you David Hume.
Exactly. So if you ask the question, well, you know, what's the limitation on that? The problem is that the basis for generalization is something that has to change with experience. We can't always generalize on the same basis, or we won't be able to sort of learn, you know, what features of the world are the important ones. Do we have to learn that necktie, you know, is the crucial feature to distinguish the right salesman from the student, and so on.
And connectionists, we haven't talked much about the details of connectionist systems, but you have all these, let's call them neurons, then, you know,
yeah,
all these units.
Yeah.
Right? You have all these units, and they're connected. And, you know, that means that information from this one can, say, feed forward to that one. But their connections have weights and mm-hmm. signs. They can either be heavy, as it were,
yeah,
a lot of weight.
Strong.
Or they can, and the sign can be positive or negative.
That's right.
Right. So and by changing the weight, I mean, I just want to, by changing the weight, you can adjust mm-hmm. the importance of this input for this calculation that the other guy does, right?
Yeah.
And that's a big, important thing.
That's right.
That means you're just not limited to, well, similar, and yeah, therefore, right.
Yeah. So, for example, when you see the same young child, let's say, every day, the child is growing and changing, and you sort of feel like you recognize the child as the same child at each day, but you know, in order for that to happen, you have to change in subtle ways what the strengths of the connections are that underlie your recognition of that child, because the child's face and the whole shape of his body and everything is just gradually evolving. And we kind of think that a huge amount of, you know, what makes us who we are is comes about through this sort of very, very gradual kind of adaptation to the sort of patterns that we experience all the time, shaping the way we react and respond to the various things that come into our experience.
So look, so a connection assistant is learns by adjusting these weights on these connections. But how does it decide how to adjust these weights? How does a connectionist system say, you know what, I used to give this lots of weight, and now I'm just going to give it a little weight? How does it do
so
that?
So there's a couple of different ways people think about that. One is, if the outcome is good, I should strengthen the connections and do more like that. And if it was bad, I should like weaken them and you know, be less likely to do the same thing again. But another way of thinking about it is that we're trying to use the experience we've just been in the midst of to help us make a prediction about what we're going to see in the next second or next few hundred milliseconds. And it's the mismatch between our expectations and what we experience that drives the change.
Right.
So this way, all of our experience, not just when we're getting rewards, can influence how we learn and change our connections.
I think it's really good. Think about, I was just thinking about this as an example the other day, because I was coaching my baseball team, right? And I gave them a practice off a tee. And here's the beautiful thing about a tee. It gives you immediate feedback on the goodness or badness of your swing, right? Because if you hit the tee, you drop your hands or something, right? And I always tell them, hit only the ball. Don't hit the tee. Well, they hit the tee, boom. And now they've got to do something different. I don't tell them what to do different. They just try to do something different in such a way that they don't hit that tee again. They've got a goal. Mm-hmm. Don't hit that tee. Hit the ball. Mm-hmm. And they kind of adjust. They got to adjust their swing. And it kind of happens like by magic somehow.
It does.
You know? But, you know, we've got lots of callers on the line who want to get into this conversation. We're talking about connectionism with Jay McClellan, one of the founding fathers of the modern version of this movement. You can join us by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Alice in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alice.
Thank you. My question goes back to a statement you initially made about when you compared AI to connectionism, and you said that with AI, computers can do well things humans do poorly, and not so well things we do well, whereas with connectionism, it more mirrors the way we behave. It doesn't do well what we do poorly, and it does well what we do well. And my question simply is, what's the point of developing a system that doesn't complement our own? You know, why not have a system that does well what we don't do well?
I'll turn that over to Jay.
Well,
thanks, Alice. Great question.
You know, I think that the best answer to that question is that there are no computers out there yet that have anything like our human mental abilities. When we think about the ability you have to retain so precisely what was said at the beginning of the talk and to understand it and ask a question back that's sort of relevant to the issues that you think about in the world, and my ability to hear the words that you say, comprehend them, and think about responding to them. Computers just aren't there. They are very good at retrieving specific information about which flight leaves at what time and when it actually landed on the ground. But if you have any kind of an open-ended question or any kind of a situation where there's imprecision or noise or variability or uncertainty, they're just not anywhere near.
And let me add, I mean, people were really impressed by classical computers because of the astounding things they can do, right? They can do calculus amazingly fast, much better than me, you know. They can do, let's say, finite mathematics as well as anything we know, you know. And people are amazingly impressed by that. But they were not sufficiently impressed by the amazing things that humans can do that those guys can't do. And when we started coming up against that, people said, oh, it can't be a computer. The artificial intelligence is way on the wrong track. But your guys say it's just the wrong style of this stuff, right? I mean, isn't that?
That's right.
Yeah. I think that's an important motivation. Let's go to more callers. Gus in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Gus.
Very good. Thank you. What a fun thing to talk about. My own daughter actually works for Tell Me, which is the company that developed the interface Ford put in place in their vehicles called Sync. And you've already covered the ground that essentially she had to cover, well, she and her coworkers had to cover, in order to come up with an interface that would work in such circumstances. I mean, I'm astounded that it's actually possible, given road noise and all the rest of it. But I think the essential thing is we have to realize that pattern recognition is the heart of it all. And yet, as you have also said, you must adjust the weight of the parameters in order to home in on what it is that the user really wants. That's the tough part, and it's very much a real-time phenomenon. It has to be dynamic. I'm going to stay on the line and shut up for a second, and maybe you could address what I've said so far.
Thanks, Gus. Jay, what do you think?
Well, I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, the dynamics has to be fast and also more gradual. You have to be able to respond in real time as the situation changes. And you have to be able to, adjust from the experience of a particular real-time experience to be ready for the next time something happens, a little bit better prepared, so you know in advance what those dynamics are going to be like. And we spend a lot of time as connectionists sort of trying to understand how the experience can adapt the system as it's happening, and then leave a residue that's there for later to make it even more sort of prepared to respond to the situation that comes along next.
So as I go about my life, and I mean, how many connectionist applications am I going to come in touch with? I mean, one of our emailers asked about Jeff Hawkins, who I think is the founder of Palm Pilot. Is the Palm Pilot something that's based on connectionism?
I think Jeff is trying to develop the next generation of Palm Pilots using connectionist-like algorithms for the future. I would say that the Palm as it exists is more like the conventional kind of computer, but he has this notion that the way the brain does it is going to help us develop.
But in general, I think John's asking a kind of general question, and you can look at, just like you can look at AI as an engineering thing. You don't care if it gets how the brain works. You just stuff that works. Yeah. Are there kind of engineering applications of connectionist neural network approaches, and sort of what's the balance between sort of classical AI approaches and, you know?
Well, I would say my take is that today we're getting closer and closer to a world in which the applications that are being developed for all kinds of things that you would have thought of as artificial intelligence are becoming very connectionist-like. When I say connectionist-like, I mean they're not necessarily framed directly in terms of neural networks, but they are framed directly in terms of adjusting the weightings that you use to compute, you know, the probability that one or another answer is the right answer to make under a given circumstance, and using feedback from the environment to update that. And these things, these ideas lie at the heart of the vehicles that win the DARPA Grand Challenge for driving across the desert and all kinds of things like that.
So let me ask you a far-out question. I mean, take the State Department. Now, the State Department could be thought of as sort of a classical computer, a bunch of people trying to make decisions by getting data in pre-established categories and communicating with each other with language. Would we be better off, I mean, just to have a big connectionist network that nobody knew how it worked, but whenever we started a war that cost us $70 million or billion dollars or trillion dollars, it would be fed back, not a good idea, adjust your weights?
Well, I think there would be some advantages to that, especially there'd be some carryover experience from one war to the next. Problem we have in our country is we replace our politicians as soon as they've begun to get any experience. And
I want to press you on this a little bit.
I think the problem is we don't replace some of them.
Yeah,
I think the point of your metaphor may be lost a little bit. Maybe I take a point out of your metaphor. I don't know if you meant this or not. One of the things in a classical computer architecture, there's something called the CPU, the guy who's in charge, who agglomerates all the information and sends out all the instructions, right, and is running the program and all that. In a connectionist system, it's all distributed. There's nothing in a certain kinds of connectionist systems anyway. At bottom, there's nothing like that.
There's all
these little guys doing each of their little thing,
yeah.
And it's only in their organization that the whole thing gets computed, right?
That's right. And I think that that really is fundamentally very important, you know, because we know that people's goals and plans do affect what they do and how they behave. But at the same time, we also know that there's a wide range of other kinds of influences on their behavior. And if you thought there was this central executive who was just sitting there deliberating, it would give you a very different feel from the, you know, there's a real-time possibility of influencing someone to make the wrong decision by giving them a kind of an influences that pushes them in the wrong way at that moment.
Now, let me ask you one more far-out question, then I'll shut up and we can dig into some more real details. But I used to know a guy named Friedrich von Hayek, who taught for a year at UCLA in the philosophy department with me, and who's an extremely famous conservative economist. And he made this distinction between kind of distributed decision making that the market does and central processing, which he was used to from the totalitarian regimes he lived under. Is this theme in economics, the advantage of things like the market that have this distributed decision making power, is that related in any way to the kind of distributed cognition that you see in connectionism?
Yeah, I think it is. I think you really can think of the neurons as being like those individual agents in the market. And, you know, there are some influences that can shape the collective activity, but they really are all working semi-independently in a collective way.
Yeah, and so and one of the things you said, just before we go to the break, the last thing, you said about connectionist-like in these systems. One thing that many people have realized, and I think it's related to this distributed thing, is that many problems are kind of multiple constraints problems. Mm-hmm. We've got all these different constraints, and this guy's trying to satisfy that constraint, and that guy's trying to satisfy that constraint, and you have to have give and take among constraints, and the solution just emerges from all of us trying to satisfy all our local constraints, and connectionist systems are kind of like that, right?
Yes,
yes.
That's exactly right.
So you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing connectionism with an innovative theory of mind of how the mind works with Jay McClellan, one of the founding fathers, and our colleague at Stanford University.
Is connectionism going to be so good at modeling the way humans think that it'll allow computer science to realize the dreams of science fiction? To create a real HAL, or an R2-D2, or a C-3PO, would this be a good thing?
The case against connectionism, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Can computers really think and learn like humans? Is connection really the way for computers to get to that point? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Jay McClellan from Stanford University. And we've got a lineup of callers on the line. Meryl in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Meryl.
I just wanted to ask about the difference, my understanding of the way the human brain works, and one of the reasons that we learn as quickly and as adaptive as we are is because of emotions and the chemistry there and the amygdala and all that. And I am not making the tired, not bringing up the thing about how computers don't have emotions and that's why they can't be as good as humans, but I'm wondering what, if anything, has been incorporated
so
about
you're, Meryl, you're thinking of stuff like Damasio's stuff on cognition. This, you know, how the emotions influence our ability to make rational decisions and stuff like that?
Help us be learning by implanting, you know, well, by giving weight, you know, just one factor
There's a couple ways of thinking about how emotions play into it. One is that when we have a very strong emotional experience, it sort of regulates the amount of change that happens to the synapses as a result of that experience. So if you're in a situation and you suddenly become quite emotional for some reason or another, changes the gain, you know, on the learning rate parameter, and just allows the connections to change more quickly in response to that specific experience. And therefore, it helps us bring those experiences back to mind more rapidly.
Was there another thing you wanted to say? I mean, it sounds like you said there are a couple of ways the emotions might play in.
Yeah, well, I think the other way is that, you know, they do change the focus of our attention. Things that are emotionally relevant to us, we spend time on. And one of the things about connectionism is the notion that as you practice, you know, your thoughts become more fluent, more articulated, more advanced. And so just the emotional engagement in a topic, getting you to think more frequently about it, really sort of pulls you into becoming an expert.
I see. Well, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about connectionism with Jay McClellan from Stanford University. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. I also thought Meryl was going to say something about the body. Well, this is one thing I think is cool for connectionism. Because if I think about you know, grasping a cup, right? And if I think in the classical ways and doing all this computing, right, I got to compute all these trajectories, right? But the connectionist says, well, you know what? The body can help me out here. Or many people who believe in situated cognition, which I think goes well with connectionist innards, you know, all I need is a collapsible hand. I got to get my hand to that cup and then just collapse it. Kind of the body takes over, and I don't have to do all that computation. And what do you think about that? Does the body embodiment help connectionism, or hurt, or is it irrelevant, or what?
I actually think the body is really a part of the connectionist network, and the error signals we get when we you're talking before about hitting a ball off a tee. You get feedback. Comes back in through your somatic sensory system every time you take any kind of an action in the world. So the neural network actually extends out to our fingertips and our entire interface with the environment.
So let me ask you a question that kind of goes back to what Ken and I were talking about at the introduction. Now, when I introspect, or if I were to explain my own behavior or yours, I would use concepts like belief and desire, and I think I can discover these things in my mind when I introspect. But where are they in this connectionist network? I mean, there must be somewhere I couldn't have that knowledge, right?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. And I'm going to take the radical version of the connectionist position here and say that, you know, those beliefs that you have that you can articulate about why you behave like you do are really actually quite irrelevant to what actually underlies the decisions and actions that you take in real time. You can come along later and rationalize what you did. In conversation with other people, you can come up with a good theory about what other people think would be a good thing for you to say when you have to explain why you did what you did. But when push comes to shove and you have to actually act, the knowledge and the connections is what's going to actually drive
it. Some people actually, I mean, just to stress what you're saying, some philosophers once used to, and some still do, defend a view that they call eliminative materialism about things like beliefs, desires, hope, fears, the things that John thinks he introspects in his mental inventory. And part of the reason they do that is because they think connectionism is a true theory about the brain and the mind. And if you look in the brain, you don't find any concrete correlates of those things that John thinks are in his mental inventory, and therefore They're it's a bunch of hooey. They're not there, right? But that seems a strong. I think I'm more confident that I have beliefs and desires and hopes and fears and plans than I am that of your connectionist story, right?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. Just how much we should go down that particular way of thinking, and I think we do have beliefs. I'm absolutely certain that, you know, I have the belief that I'm talking to you guys, you know, at the radio station right now. But the question of where they come from, how they arise, how they change, maybe they have a connection to substrate, really.
So to go back to the example of economics, if you watch CNBC or any of these shows that talk about the market as things are actually happening, and they say things like, well, the market is, you know, reacting to what's-his-name speech, or the market is worried because banks in Asia are failing. And you think, you know, that's hooey, right? I mean, the market is doing what it does because zillions of people all over the world are reacting to zillions of things. And yet, there's something right about what they say. So do you think beliefs are kind of like that?
I think beliefs are like that in a way. I think they're, you know, I think the thing that I would say about beliefs is that they're things that we are comfortable with as a result of having thought them many times often. And when we get confronted with thoughts we haven't had before, they often seem uncomfortable or difficult to have. And, you know, they make us...
But let me give you one more kind of skepticism that people have expressed about connectionism. And this was a battle royale for a while in which you were deeply engaged. So look, think about thought. I mean, how many thoughts can I think? Well, I can think it's raining, but then I can think John believes it's raining. I can think Mary believes that John believes that it's raining. I can think if Mary believes that John believes that it's raining, then something else. So it can keep going. I can think an infinity of thoughts. Not only that, if I can think John loves Mary, people used to say, I can also think for free Mary loves John. You know, sometimes I do some calculation and I run out of memory. I add some memory. I can do more, you know. People said connectionism misses the infinitary character of thought, the systematic nature of thought, the distinction between performance and competence. It just misses all these things. Yeah. You take any of those that you like.
Well, you know, what I would say in response is that the approaches that others have taken to try to capture that miss the subtlety and the flexibility of thought. So when you talk about love, for example, John loves Mary, maybe... Mary's love for John is a similar kind of love as John's love for Mary. But what about the Pope's love for sinners and John's love for ice cream? Are these the same thing? Actually, every word means something a little different in every context. And in order to be able to deal with that context sensitivity, we need something other than the strict systems of rules that the other guys
are talking about. Let's get one last caller in here, perhaps. Philip in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philip.
Hi, thank you. I was curious. I heard Ray Kurzweil, the guy who wrote The Age of Spiritual Machines, talking about the future of brains and so forth. And I was wondering, super intelligent machines and so forth. I was wondering, is it your guess view that by 2040, if Moore's law stays consistent and processing of computers doubles every 18 months or so, that we will by 2040 or thereabouts have sufficient processing power to mimic the raw physical connectivity of a human brain? And if we do, how hard would it be to write software for that brain?
So that's a great question, and let me answer both parts. The first part, will Moore's law get us there? I think we really need to start thinking about different architectures. So Moore's law is important. It allows us to pack more onto a chip. But the chip still has a flat geometry. And one of the things about the brain is the massive interdigitation of connectivity that's possible in a three-dimensional structure. The other thing is, will we be able to program this thing? So my colleagues in computer science... and the people I know in robotics, who I think of as being at the cutting edge, are people who are asking themselves, how does this device program itself? What are the learning rules that will allow something that we'll be able to build 25 years from now to learn the way we do so that it can become, as capable as we are?
So, but I guess you would predict that whoever gets there first is going to be the connect... Somebody's going to get there first, either the classical symbolic AI or the connectionist, or maybe some hybrid of the two. I mean, who's going to get there first? I assume you're going to say the connectionist.
I think it's a levels of analysis issue. We haven't talked about this.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so at some level, there's this connectionist architecture, right? There's neurons and connections, and everybody agrees with that. And there's, at another level, there is this notion that, you know, you have this particular thought in your mind right now. So when you talked at the beginning of the show about working up from the bottom, I think what we're going to find out is that the way we process symbols is going to be different than we used to think because we got there from a connectionist substrate.
Right. Right. So, I mean, I think that's a pretty picture, and it's the one I kind of endorse. I mean, so if we start from the bottom up, it starts to look one way. We start from the top down, we start with different starting points. What we'd like is to meet in the middle, these two approaches to meet in the middle, and everything kind of gets revised, and we get a new picture, and maybe we stop talking about beliefs, but we start talking about these other higher-level states that are more revealing.
Well, maybe people start writing the book, reading the book I wrote in 2001 that provides a new picture, but you know, you never know.
So, Jay, you're going to be leaving us shortly, but what's your last thought? Give me your last thought on whatever you want about connection, something we haven't covered or whatever.
Well, I guess what I'd like to say is that it's one of my own personal frustrations has been how long it's taken for connectionism to start becoming a part of the fabric of the way people think. And
that's why we did a show on philosophy talk.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But you know, since I'm the kind of guy who thinks that gradual exposure and multiple opportunities shapes how the minds work, I'm feeling optimistic about the future of the ideas.
Well, Jay, thank you for joining. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Jay McClellan, professor of psychology at Stanford University, one of the founding fathers of the modern connectionist movement, co-author of Semantic Cognition, a Parallel Distributed Processing Approach. So, John, what did you learn today?
Well, I learned a lot today, but I want to mention what I was reminded of. 20 years ago, I guess, in the 80s, my friend and colleague and collaborator John Barweis and I first started talking about connectionism. The works of Rummelhart and McClellan and all these great people became available to us, and we tried to get to the bottom of it. And, of course, he was a lot smarter than I was, so he got a lot further towards the bottom. But he really just didn't seem to warm up to connectionism. And I finally said, well, what? I mean, philosophically, I mean, what's your problem with connectionism? Why do you prefer these logical ways of doing things? He said, I don't have any problem with being true. I just don't like that kind of mathematics. And I think a lot of intellectual disputes at the bottom have to do with the kind of mathematics that various really high-powered theorists find comfortable. And that's my deep thought for the day.
Well, that's your deep thought for the day. I don't know. I mean, I actually spent a lot of time in the 80s and the 90s plunging in to connectionism and these debates between classical architectures and connectionist architectures. And it was, you can't imagine how heated it got. One of my still dear friends and former colleagues, a man named Jerry Fodor, one of the great philosophers of mind of our age, he wrote these articles, these inflammatory articles, got all these people inflamed. And Jay was involved in some of these debates, you know. It was really, and then I actually couldn't figure out what deeply it was all about, because it's thought to me that connectionism had certain insights, the classical thing had certain insights. I thought there probably were ways to marry the insights of the two together, you know.
It's always seemed to me that kind of a connectionist basement and first floor and second floor could somehow be married to a 55th floor that's fairly
classical.
I agree, classical.
That's why I wish we had
to get work on the other 40 floors.
I wish we had had more time to talk about that levels of analysis thing that Jay mentioned, but we didn't. But the conversation continues on our website, on our blog, actually, the blog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog.
Yeah, and I hope Jay will add a blog, and I know Ken's got to. He has such knowledge about this subject. You can also download podcasts of our program from our website. And if you have a conundrum, by the way, a practical problem or a philosophical problem that's been scratching at your brain, let us know about it, and maybe we'll help you think about the issue in a philosophical and possibly completely impractical manner.
Yeah, just click the conundrum button at our website and tell us about it. We'll see if philosophy can help solve your conundrum.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2008.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein is our director of research. Lael Weiss is our webmaster. Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Philosophy Talk is sponsored in part by Powell City of Books, on the web at powells.com. Support also comes from the Templeton Foundation.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.